You know, when you think about corporate bribery, I feel like you probably picture something straight out of a spy movie.
Right, like a briefcase full of unmarked, non-sequential bills.
Exactly. Slid across some dimly lit table in an underground parking garage. The stakes are clear. The action is, obviously illegal, and it's very easy to spot.
The cinematic version of corruption is always so binary. I mean, it's just a direct transaction, cash for a specific immediate favor.
But then if you look at how modern global business actually operates, suddenly that briefcase is just, well, it's nowhere to be found.
Yeah, it's completely gone.
Instead, it's replaced by, like, a beautifully wrapped seasonal fruit basket, or maybe a seemingly innocent business lunch at a mid-tier steakhouse.
Yeah.
And the line between a polite professional courtesy and a literal federal crime becomes incredibly murky.
Oh, absolutely.
So welcome to this deep dive. Today, we are immersing ourselves in a stack of sources detailing Thailand's National Anti-Corruption Commission, the NACC, and their No Gift Culture initiative.
Which is such a fascinating case study.
It really is. So, okay, let's unpack this, because our mission today for you, the listener, isn't just about figuring out, when to politely refuse a basket of mangoes. We are exploring how ordinary business courtesies secretly double as corporate bribery,
Yeah.
and how a simple etiquette campaign actually reveals the complex machinery of corporate control, compliance, and honestly, human psychology.
What's fascinating here is that this source material fundamentally changes how we define a bribe in the corporate world.
Right.
It moves the focus entirely away from the actual monetary value of a physical object and zeroes in on intent and context.
Yes, intent is everything.
It challenges the very framework of how multinational companies manage their risk, showing us that a bribe isn't always a bag of cash. Often, I mean, it's just everyday business, slightly twisted to exploit a vulnerability.
Which is wild to think about. But before we can understand how companies are supposed to prevent bribery, we kind of have to understand how easily it disguises itself as just normal behavior. Like, I want you, the listener, to think about your own professional interactions for a second. Gifts and hospitality are standard features of building commercial relationships.
They're expected in a lot of ways.
Exactly. You send a modest holiday gift to a vendor. You host a client dinner after a long day of meetings. You have a ceremonial exchange to express appreciation. It doesn't automatically mean you expect favorable treatment in return. It's how humans build rapport.
But the NACC points out that the exact same mechanisms used to say thank you or let's work together can be weaponized. They can disguise a transfer of value.
Right.
A benefit doesn't need to be officially described as a payment to influence a public official. The person giving the gift might just call it relationship building.
Relationship building, yeah. That's the classic excuse. The sources emphasize that context
Yeah.
is vastly more important than the actual monetary value of the gift.
Context is everything.
Let's look at a practical example. A standard $50 lunch during a normal working meeting in the middle of a Tuesday is considered low risk. I mean, it's customary.
Right. Totally normal.
But take that exact same $50 meal and move it to a private one-on-one dinner with a government official who is currently deciding on an urgent operating license for your manufacturing plant.
Oof.
Suddenly, that identical meal is a massive bribery risk.
Because the context has completely altered the intent of the meal. The NNACC provides very specific warning signs that can turn a basic courtesy into a serious liability.
Yeah, tell us about those.
So the first and most critical is timing.
Okay.
Is the benefit being offered during a procurement process or a regulatory inspection or maybe a licensing period?
Like when a big decision is hanging in the balance.
Exactly. If a public decision is pending, any transfer of value, no matter how small, creates an immediate conflict of interest.
And the sources outlined a few other litmus tests too, which I found super interesting. You have to look at who initiated the interaction.
Yes.
Was this dinner requested by the official rather than initiated through normal scheduled business protocols?
Which is a huge red flag.
Right. Or does the benefit magically include the official's family members or associates who literally have no business being there?
Right, like why is the spouse at the tech vendor lunch?
Exactly. And is there an actual proportionate business rationale for what's happening? But my personal favorite test, mentioned in the sources, this is great. Would this cause embarrassment if it were disclosed publicly?
The front page test.
Yes. Imagine the receipt for that dinner and the names of the attendees just being published on the front page of the morning paper.
That public disclosure test cuts through a lot of corporate rationalization. If a manager feels the need to hide an expense or, describe it vaguely in the accounting system, corrupt intent is highly likely to be present.
It's a bit like a speeding ticket versus reckless driving.
How do you mean?
Well, driving 45 miles an hour is perfectly legal on a sunny highway, right? But doing it through a school zone during a blizzard is a crime.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
The physical action is exactly the same, but the environmental context changes everything. How many ordinary coffees or lunches in corporate America might look incredibly suspicious on paper if an auditor realized they happened, like, 3 days before a major municipal contract was awarded?
It's an uncomfortable thought for many professionals who view networking as a core part of their job.
Oh, for sure.
And this is exactly why the NACC stresses that corruption cannot be stopped just by telling public officials to say no to gifts. The supply side, meaning the private companies, they must be held accountable.
Right. It's a two-way street.
You cannot just regulate the demand for bribes. You have to cut off the supply. If private organizations aren't rigorously inspecting their own expenditures, corrupt officials will always find a way to demand those benefits.
Wait, let me play devil's advocate and push back on that a bit.
Okay, go for it.
If the rules are entirely about context and intent, isn't that impossibly subjective for a company to monitor? Like, this brings us to a massive misconception that businesses have, particularly regarding Thailand's specific financial rules.
Ah, the safe harbor myth.
Yes, the safe harbor myth. So under Thai rules, state officials are permitted to accept certain gifts or benefits up to 3,000 baht, which is what? Roughly 80 or 90 U.S. dollars?
Something like that, yeah.
Doesn't a hard financial threshold like that give companies a clear legal safe harbor? I mean, they think if it's under 3,000 baht, they aren't breaking the law.
That is a catastrophic misinterpretation of the law, but it is incredibly common.
Really?
Oh, yeah. The 3,000 baht rule is strictly limited to very defined circumstances. It has to be from a person who is not a relative, the exchange must be based on an ethical or customary occasion, and it must be intended generally rather than specifically to purchase influence.
Right, so you can't just hand someone 80 bucks for no reason.
Exactly. The source material explicitly warns that monetary thresholds are meant to be control triggers. They are not automatic declarations of legitimacy.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Companies treat this 3,000 baht threshold like someone on a diet who thinks eating a whole chocolate cake is perfectly fine as long as they only eat it one microscopic crumb at a time.
Yes. They engage in what the sources call threshold gaming.
Threshold gaming. Let's walk through how that actually looks in practice because it's pretty sneaky.
It really is. Imagine four executives from a foreign tech company are trying to woo a Thai telecommunications regulator.
So?
They take this official to a lavish dinner that costs 10,000 baht. If one executive submits that receipt, it triggers an immediate compliance alert because it exceeds the 3,000 baht limit per person.
Right. The system would flag it immediately.
So they don't submit one receipt. The four executives ask the restaurant to split the bill four ways.
Oh, wow.
They each put 2,500 baht on their individual corporate credit cards. On paper, to a mid-level accounting clerk reviewing hundreds of expense reports, it looks like four entirely separate compliant meals. They stayed under the diet threshold.
That is crazy. How on earth is a company supposed to catch this kind of micro-cheating when the employees are actively working together to obscure the context?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it explains why modern anti-bribery investigators rely so heavily on aggregating data rather than looking at isolated transactions.
Aggregating data.
Right. Because an isolated 2,500 baht dinner looks fine, but if your internal systems are designed to aggregate data by the recipient, a very different picture emerges.
Oh, I see where this is going.
The system flags that this specific government official received 10,000 baht worth of hospitality on the exact same night from four different cost centers within your company, right while a network license is under review.
Boom. The aggregation proves the intent.
Exactly.
It strips away the disguise of a customary courtesy and reveals a targeted campaign of influence. A benefit offered with corrupt intent is a bribe, regardless of whether it was split into compliant-looking fractions.
The objective of an anti-bribery policy isn't to eliminate ordinary professional interaction. It's to remove ambiguity, where a personal benefit could reasonably be connected to the exercise of public authority.
Okay, so if a company implements this kind of internal tracking, and the employees know they can't expense these lavish lunches or split bills anymore without getting caught by the system, the bribes don't just stop, do they?
Oh, definitely not.
The risk just changes shape. The employees move the behavior off the books entirely.
That is the natural evolution of corporate corruption. When direct gifts are heavily scrutinized, companies shift the risk by using hidden currencies.
Hidden currencies.
Yeah. Bribery often isn't a physical object or a restaurant receipt at all.
The sources highlight some fascinating examples of these hidden currencies. We're talking about, like, covering luxury travel under the guise of site visits.
Yes.
Or paying for an official's medical accommodations. But one that really stood out to me was employment opportunities. An official might strongly imply that their recent college graduate nephew is looking for a job.
Providing a job is a massive transfer of value. The sources note that this is especially risky if a position is magically created with no real business need.
Like a phantom job.
Right. Or if normal competitive recruitment requirements, like multiple rounds of interviews or specific degree requirements, are suddenly waived right around the time a government matter is pending.
Man, that is subtle. And it extends to charitable donations and community sponsorships, too. A company might fund a local sports facility or a regional charity.
Which looks great on paper.
Exactly. On the corporate public relations page, it looks like fantastic corporate social responsibility.
Yeah.
But if you dig deeper and find out that the charity is secretly controlled by a public official who regulates that company's industry, or maybe it's run by their spouse, it's just a hidden bribe.
The exact same principle applies to political contributions made secretly through a third-party organization. The value is being transferred to benefit the official just through a sanitized proxy.
Which brings us to a massive, glaring vulnerability for multinational corporations. The third-party threat.
This is a huge one.
Companies use local agents, distributors, customs brokers, joint venture partners, and consultants all the time to navigate foreign markets.
All the time. It's standard practice.
Since an actual employee of the company might never interact with a public official. Instead, they hire a local consultant and pay them this loosely defined success fee or a consultancy fee.
And the intermediary's only real value to the company in these scenarios is often their unexplained access to government officials.
Unexplained access.
Yeah. When an agent claims that unofficial, undocumented payments are necessary because, you know, this is how business is done in this region, they are telling you exactly what they are doing with that commission.
Wait, I'm struggling with this third-party liability concept a little bit. Let's play devil's advocate again.
Okay.
If I'm an executive sitting in an office in London or New York, and I hire a local consultant in Bangkok to expedite a factory permit, and I explicitly put in their contract in bold letters, do not break the law, comply with all local regulations, shouldn't that protect my company? I mean, I can't control what this independent contractor does with their own commission behind my back. I didn't tell them to bribe anyone.
A stand-up clause in a contract will not save you.
Really?
Not at all. Under Section 176 of Thailand's Organic Act on Counter-Corruption, delegating the interaction does not delegate the risk.
Wow.
The law creates strict exposure for both individuals and legal entities. If a juristic person, meaning a legally recognized corporate entity, benefits from a bribe paid by an associated individual, and the company lacked appropriate internal controls to prevent it, the company faces massive fines.
So even if the consultant is acting independently, if my company reaps the financial reward of that expedited permit, we are on the hook.
You're absolutely on the hook. And the sources note this applies to foreign companies operating in Thailand as well, not just local Thai businesses.
Yeah, that is a huge wake-up call.
It establishes the crucial legal difference between having a policy on paper and actually having operational immunity. Just having a dusty code of conduct policy in your employee handbook that says, we do not tolerate bribery, doesn't make you immune to prosecution.
It sounds like the law looks at whether your controls were genuinely implemented and proportionate to your specific operational risk.
Precisely. A multinational logistics corporation with extensive daily customs exposure, hundreds of border crossings, and dozens of third-party agents needs a vastly different, more rigorous control environment than, say, a small local bakery with minimal public sector interaction.
That makes total sense.
The legal defense is entirely operational. If you are investigated under Section 176, you have to prove what specific risks you identified in your third-party supply chain, what due diligence you performed on that consultant before hiring them, and how you audited their activities.
Okay, we've seen the traps. We've talked about how environmental context turns a standard lunch into a felony, how people aggressively exploit the 3,000-baht loophole through threshold gaming, and how third-party intermediaries serve as these giant corporate blind spots.
Right.
So how does a well-intentioned company actually protect itself
The source material provides a really fascinating breakdown of why corporate compliance policies typically fail in practice. And the first failure mode they identify is excessive simplicity.
Excessive simplicity. So like a one-line ban saying no gifts. It sounds great in a boardroom, but it fails the moment it hits the real world.
Exactly.
Imagine you are a front desk receptionist. A local vendor sends a massive, beautiful floral arrangement to the office during a holiday. Does the receptionist just throw it in the trash? Do they mail it back?
It's an impossible situation for them.
Yeah. A blanket no gifts policy doesn't give staff any actual protocols for handling unsolicited deliveries or navigating legitimate, culturally significant ceremonial events.
And without specific protocols, employees will just guess. And usually, they will guess in whatever way avoids immediate social awkwardness.
Of course they will.
Another critical failure mode the sources highlight is unmanaged executive exceptions.
Oh, man. This is the absolute killer of corporate culture.
It really is.
Imagine you're a junior sales rep, right? You just got hauled into a severe disciplinary meeting with human resources because you accepted a $20 box of chocolates from a supplier. You get a formal warning.
Right.
But on your way back to your desk, you look down the hall and see the vice president of sales authorizing a first-class golf conference trip for a key government official with zero compliance oversight. Simply because that VP brings in millions of dollars in revenue.
It happens all the time.
As a junior employee, you are going to immediately realize the policy is a joke.
This creates a parallel, unregulated system just for VIPs. And that inevitably leads to inconsistent discipline. Employees will never buy into a zero-tolerance message if the top-performing sales personnel or the senior executives are completely exempt from the consequences of risky behavior.
It's like putting a state-of-the-art biometric security system on the front door of your house, but leaving the back door wide open and off its hinges for the VIPs.
That's a perfect analogy.
Yeah.
If the top salesperson doesn't have to follow the rules, the whole culture of compliance is a sham. I want to ask you, the listener, to think about your own workplace. If you saw a senior executive splitting a suspicious dinner bill across multiple credit cards, would you actually feel safe reporting it to your HR department?
A lot of people wouldn't.
Right. Because if your answer is no, your company's anti-bribery policy has already failed.
Unsafe whistleblowing hotlines where employees fear career retaliation for speaking up are a recipe for systemic failure. So to counter all of this, the NSEC laid out 8 principles and what the sources refer to as the resilient control stack.
Resilient control stack. That sounds intense. This moves way beyond just a symbolic refusal of seasonal fruit baskets.
Way beyond it.
The resilient stack starts with risk-based prior approval. Yeah. So if an employee is interacting with a high-risk recipient, or navigating a government touchpoint like a permit application, any transfer of value requires independent compliance review before the money is ever spent.
That's the key part. Before, they also emphasized the necessity of a central register.
What does that look like?
Every single benefit, hospitality, travel, charitable donations, sponsorship, it all needs to be recorded in one central searchable database. This is how investigators actually aggregate the data by recipient and project to spot those patterns of influence we discussed earlier.
Ah, so you can't just hide it in separate spreadsheets. And this leads to what might be the most fascinating technical mechanism in the sources, accounts payable analytics.
Yes.
We aren't just talking about accountants making sure the receipts match the spreadsheet anymore.
No, this requires shifting the accounts payable department from just being cashiers to acting as internal detectives.
Internal detectives. Imagine an AI or an automated software system scanning thousands of mundane receipts. To a human manager approving one expense report at a time, a $2,999 VAT dinner looks completely fine.
They just rubber stamp it.
Right. But the software is actively looking for anomalies. It notices that 4 different employees expensed exactly $2,999 VAT at the same restaurant on the same night.
It sees the big picture.
It flags suspiciously round value claims, like an exactly 10,000 BAT consulting fee with no itemized breakdown. It flags duplicate amounts. It's basically an automated defense against threshold gaming.
This raises an important question for financial crime leaders. How do you permanently connect your corporate culture with these technical controls?
How do you do it?
You have to tie anti-bribery initiatives directly to human resources. Recruitment, performance incentives, and promotions must actively reinforce the policy.
Oh, that makes sense. You cannot reward an employee with a massive six-figure bonus for achieving commercial results if they used uncontrolled, high-risk methods like paying off a shady third-party consultant to get those results.
Exactly. The incentives have to align with the compliance.
Anti-bribery has to be an ongoing, living operating model, not just a seasonal email from HR reminding people not to accept mangoes.
And there is also a powerful element of collective strength required to change a business environment.
What do you mean by collective strength?
Well, the sources highlight the Thai Private Sector Collective Action Against Corruption. It basically operates as a certification framework.
Oh, so it's a group effort. Let's look at the harsh commercial reality here. A single company that refuses to pay bribes in a highly corrupt region might be terrified of losing market share to competitors who are perfectly willing to play dirty.
That's the main fear.
There is a massive commercial disadvantage to being the only ethical player in the room.
But if a massive group of companies representing significant market power all adopt and certify to common, rigorous anti-corruption standards, it dramatically alters the landscape.
Because there's safety in numbers.
Precisely. It reduces the commercial penalty of being ethical. If the entire supply chain agrees not to pay bribes, corrupt officials lose their leverage. It creates peer pressure for integrity standards to move throughout the entire economy.
That is incredibly powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Thailand's No Gift Initiative is really a masterclass in seeing through the disguises of corporate influence.
It really is.
It proves that human intent matters far more than a specific price tag. It shows that your third-party consultants and agents are your biggest legal blind spots, and that true compliance requires a resilient, evidence-led system that connects human resources, accounting analytics, and leadership.
It demands that organizations truly understand their public sector touchpoints. They have to be capable of challenging influential, high-performing employees before the value is transferred, not just managing the fallout after the fact.
We've talked so much today about accounts payable analytics, central registers, and AI software scanning expense reports to catch threshold gaming.
We covered a lot of ground.
We did. But I want to leave you, the listener, with a final thought to mull over, building entirely on the source's central premise that intent and context are the true markers of a bribe.
Okay, let's hear it.
If the fundamental difference between a perfectly legitimate, customary $2,500 bad vendor lunch and a highly corrupt $2,500 bad vendor lunch is purely the human intention behind it, well, wait, how can any automated accounting system or AI ever truly flag a bribe?
That is the big question.
Think about that for your own company. Can you ever really audit human intention?
It is the ultimate enduring challenge of compliance.
It really is. So the next time someone offers you a seasonal fruit basket or invites you to a seemingly ordinary lunch, just remember, sometimes an apple isn't just an apple. It might just be the X-ray you need to see the hidden machinery operating beneath the surface of global business. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive, and keep looking closely at the everyday interactions around you. See you next time.